Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it's 2:56 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is Friday, and it's February 24th. So it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, the thing that has been going in, along in the back of my mind for a while is what I kind of think of as the pendulum effect. So, if you swing a pendulum as far in one direction as it possibly can go, then when you leave it go, it swings in the opposite direction, almost an equal measure in the opposite direction. And then it swings back, but it doesn't quite get to where it was at the beginning. So it looks like a pendulum will keep going for a long time, but eventually it'll come to rest. And incrementally, those swings get narrower over time. And I kind of think that that is what we're seeing in the broad global economy, both in terms of how inflation is measured, but then also how geopolitical tensions are manifesting as well. So the first thing is that we had a huge shock. So here on the S&P 500, we can see that in March of 2020, the S&P 500 fell 35%, and that's a good size crash. And subsequently, we had a massive response. But I think very few people tend to think about the speed with which that massive response took place and join it up with the fact that the Federal Reserve at the time was already thinking about how they were going to start easing. They already had an inverted yield curve in 2019. It's worth just reminding ourselves of exactly what we had back in the 2019 period, because I was starting to get really worried about the potential for a recession in the period 2020 through 2021. The 10-year minus the 3-month yield curve spread was well below zero in 2019. And then we had a couple of wobbles. There were persistent fears of deflation, and yet because of tightening liquidity, there had been significant issues in the repo market. The Fed had to step in and introduce what is effectively a de facto standing repo facility. Now, subsequently, and it did take about 18 months to 2 years, they formalized it. So now there's definitely a standing repo facility. Well, now we have an even more inverted yield curve. But perhaps I think more important than that, just think about this fact that the last time we had a yield curve as wide as 233 basis points was in 2015. And by the time the yield curve became inverted for the first time was 2019. So it took 4 years to go from that point of about 230 basis points to the point of inversion. And in 2022, we were at that point in May, and the yield curve was inverted by October. So instead of thinking about 4 years, it happened in 5 months. So I think it is reasonable, therefore, to conclude that we have not yet seen the knock-on effect of this tightening. So it also then just let's think about this, that back in 2019, there were fears about an impending recession. There had been a massive inflation of private assets, and there were companies that were just beginning to IPO because they hadn't been able, or they hadn't really found the need to IPO previously. They were having money showered upon them. And Uber is a good example of that. It IPO'd in 2019, and then it went straight down. So I think that's a good example. And then Lyft was another company that IPO'd right around the same time. And we had, and it's still making new lows. But they came to market because their values had inflated so much that they were having difficulty getting additional new cash. Liquidity was drying up, so they went to the stock market to try and get some money out. So then the private equity ventures started taking some of their money out. And then let's also remember that the original issues with WeWork happened in 2019. And that business model, where the company was basically offering office space in prime locations, in prime buildings, at rates that were below the prevailing market rate, and they still expected to make money from that. And there was tens, if not hundreds of billions showered upon that business model. And yet people were surprised when it went bad. And then, of course, we had the movie pass, movie tickets. It was obviously the same business model, but on a smaller scale, where somebody could pay about $3 to $4 a month and then watch as many movies as they wanted in a cinema. Well, MoviePass went bust much faster than WeWork. WeWork is now on the cusp of going bust. And I think it is also particularly worth highlighting that the company IPO'd in 2020, having in fact gone really got into trouble and ditching their CEO, then handing him this really impressive golden handshake just to leave. Then they listed the company, and since then it has lost about 87% of its value. And it's still making new lows, and there's a strong likelihood that it's going to go bust. And I think at that point, then they're going to have really serious conversations with their creditors. Let's just shelve that discussion for a moment and then think about the pendulum effect. So, as we think about what was happening in 2019 and the fact that there was liquidity tightening up, issues with the repo market, and that companies were starting to list, that was going to be a new source of supply coming onto the market, which is typical in late stages of bull markets. Then the pandemic hit. It was a big surprise for everyone. And since they were already thinking about beginning to cut rates and make liquidity more available, then they just hit the acceleration button. So we can see then graphically that the size of the Fed's balance sheet went from less than 4 trillion to about 7 trillion in the space of about 2 months. And then over the course of the next year, went up to about 9 trillion. So they've taken about 700 million. Excuse me, 700 billion out of circulation since the peak in about February of last year. So that's a contraction of about 700 billion in 9 months. And the last time they took 750 million out of circulation in 18 months. So not only are they raising interest rates very quickly, but that they are also reducing the size of the balance sheet twice as fast as they did in that period. So on the one hand, we had this massive amount of liquidity where interest rates collapsed, the amount of money being printed went up. Then we had government stimulus where the deficits of major economies went through the roof, and money was poured into the system to compensate for the complete cessation of economic activity, and then giving funds directly to consumers contributed to inflationary pressures. So inflation took off in 2021 and early 22. So that was pulling the pendulum back. Then it swung very heavily in the opposite direction, and it's still swinging. It's still out there on the extreme. So we haven't yet seen the swing back towards deflation. And until we do, interest rates are going to continue to rise. So now the big question is not so much about how fast interest rates have already gone up, going from a quarter of a percent up to 4.75% in less than a year is a mightily impressive pace of interest rate hiking, and faster than we've seen in an awfully long time. So that is contracting liquidity, and we already know that the size of the Fed's balance sheet has been contracting. Now let's also then look at the total assets of central banks on a global basis, taking all of the big central banks. Now this is a redenominated chart into US dollars, and therefore it is going to be heavily impacted by how the dollar in fact performs. And of course, because the dollar was weak for about 3 to 4 months, then it helped to support the index. Now it does take quite a while to load, but the important point here is that it is now starting to roll over again. So this is looking like a significant unwind of this massive expansion that we saw in 2020 through to the beginning of 2022. The total assets of global central banks went from about 20.5 trillion to 33.3 trillion. So that was a phenomenally large quantity of debt. And there has been a massive knock-on effect, because the volume of bonds that were trading with a negative yield has now contracted from about 17 trillion to about 1 trillion. And as recently as last month, it was zero. So this has been a hugely difficult time for bond investors, because anyone who was buying any of this negative yielding debt between 2016 and 2021 is now underwater on those positions. So one is then praying that the price will go back up. And there is a loss baked in that when you have sharply inverted yields, well then, when you're buying at a negative yield, then you're not going to get paid back more than parity. So obviously, that's obviously going to be a really significant issue, particularly when there were several bonds, and particularly German bonds, that were trading out to prices that were like 110 or even 120, and they will then redeem at par. And the 10-year Bund yield is now north of 2.5%, so jumping on the upside here. And it's, I think, underappreciated just how much German property prices went up during the zero interest rate, exceptionally low priced or low interest rate environment. So Adler Group was trading up around 49 euro in 2018, and now it's trading at 1. And there is a strong likelihood it will be driven into bankruptcy. Now, German companies tend to be nationalized when they start to go bankrupt. But there have been several companies that have gone bust, both within the banking sector, the fintech sector, and now the real estate sector in the German economy over the last decade. And it hasn't really impacted the wider economy. But I remember 20 years ago, property in Munich was considered to be really quite cheap. And now it's among some of the most expensive in Europe. It's understandable because it's a beautiful city and full of culture and very close to some beautiful scenery. But quite whether that is going to last when you have interest rates that are rising, and tightening global liquidity is another question entirely. So let's then think about this pendulum, because we still have inflationary pressures, and money is still going to consumers. And I just had a perfect example of that myself this morning. I got an email from Chase, who issued my mortgage. They first told me that that they had miscalculated how much they had to withhold to pay property taxes. So I'm going to get a refund, which is equivalent to a month and a half of my mortgage payment. And then on top of that, my mortgage payment next year is going to be about, let me see, it's going to be $543 less. And that's because property taxes are coming down in Texas. Well, every single homeowner in the state is going to be receiving the same information today. And it means that suddenly everybody has more money in their pockets. So that's really stimulative. It's actually more money that, and because it is really going to favor the people that have more expensive properties and therefore pay more expensive property taxes, then it's a front-loaded tax rebate. And that's going to certainly be an economic stimulus. Of course, what it also means is that it's going to become, there's likely to be a big discussion over the next year about competitive locations for state taxes. And this has always been about the state tax, and very little has ever been talked about the property tax, because obviously different properties cost more or less. But when property taxes are going down in some states and going up in others, then that is going to create a competitive environment. I don't believe, though, that it is residential property is going to be the problem in this on this occasion. I think that we're now at the point where we've had a big swing in inflation and everyone has been shocked. And now we're seeing interest rates rising aggressively. Now, because those interest rates have risen, we have had this huge move in interest rates without a knock-on effect in the economy. So by some measures, economies are getting weaker, but Europe was able to avoid a recession. And a good part of the reason was because of natural gas. So Dutch natural gas prices went through the roof in 2022, but we get very little discussion about why. And it's a very simple reason. Everyone was terrified that there was going to be an economic Armageddon as a result of Russian exports being refused. So we had price insensitive buying by European utilities, and they did what was necessary to fill their reserves. And as soon as they had filled their reserves, they stopped buying and prices collapsed. Well, then because that threat of economic Armageddon was forestalled, well, then banks were able to bring all the money that they'd set aside for defaults back on balance sheet. So we've had a good sized rally in European banks, where they came up from about 100, excuse me, from 75 to about 120. Now we're seeing some resistance coming in, and I suspect that we're going to see a good size consolidation. And this was also true for several of the UK banks, where they also rallied quite impressively. And now we're seeing greater evidence of some resistance coming in and deeper processes of consolidation going on. What we can definitely think about is that the recession, which was threatened as a result of the war, was avoided in 2022, And that was done because there was massive spending. That does not mean that recessions of the future will be avoided if central banks continue to raise rates and that governments are no longer in a position to go out and spend money with absolutely no regard for prices. So there is a strong likelihood that we've had an inflationary shock, and because of the medicine that is now being applied, that what we're going to have in future is a deflationary shock. Then we're likely to have another inflationary shock, and it might not be quite as bad as the last one. But of course, prices will rise above where they are right now, and then there will have to be a need for even more monetary tightening. And I think this pendulum effect is rather similar to what we had in the 1970s. Now, I think it's important also to think about the wage price spiral and what drove that in the 1970s. Well, one big difference between now and then was the number of unionized workers. So the USA does not have very many union workers, but the UK does. And we are already seeing several of those unions striking. So we've got nurses and we've got train drivers, we've got junior doctors. There was even barristers were striking. Well, what that also suggests is that there will be upward pressure on wages, and the government is trying, I think, rather admirably to try and contain some of that upward pressure and having quite a bit of difficulty doing it. And because it's an island economy, then inflation generally tends to run higher anyway. So then obviously there are very significant questions about whether Brexit is in fact going to happen. And there are active negotiations going on right now. But I think one important fact, I should just move that chart, I should say, back into pounds. But I think one important fact to pay attention to is that the UK has signed treaties, and one of those treaties is going to have to be broken, or one group of people is going to have to be enormously discomforted. Now, it would make sense from a political and electoral perspective to tick off the unionists in Northern Ireland. Breaking the Good Friday Agreement would be reneging on an international treaty between two countries. But that would be putting the border down between the six counties in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. But it's not beyond the bounds of possibility, but Ireland has been negotiating with the backing of the EU. So that will be a difficult one to do. The Boris Johnson's solution was to put the border down the middle of the Irish Sea, and that ticked off the Ulster Unionists. But if the UK is going to, and by the UK, what we're really talking about is England, Wales, and Scotland, if the UK is going to have Brexit as conceived by those who voted for it, then that's the only real solution. And of course, if the Northern Ireland question is to be solved, and then the choice is made to instead tick off all of the Eurosceptics who voted for Brexit, well, then what we're in fact going to get is Brexit Lite, which is Brexit in name only. And I think that, considering that Rishi Sunak is from the more, or let's just say the less Eurosceptic grouping within the Conservative Party, then that is a growing threat. Now, there is the potential that it may help to ameliorate some of the inflationary pressures in the short term by easing trade between the UK and the EU. But I suspect that that is a red herring. Because we already know that a lot of the problems with the supply chain are more to do with the lack of natural gas and the exceptionally high cost of fertilizer rather than access to transportation. So when Morocco is looking at curtailing exports of tomatoes or exports of onions, that's not because of Brexit. That's simply because they haven't had access to fertilizer and the cost of production has been very high, particularly when they've had drought conditions. And running a greenhouse in a northern cold climate is very dependent on heating. And without it, then you end up with a lot of withered crops. So then this is not the fact that you have empty store shelves in places like the UK and much of Europe. Because there simply isn't enough of supply in the short term, that does not mean that it's going to turn into a long-term problem. But we are going to see demand for more fertilizer, and we are looking at the clear potential that there will be demand for more food. Obviously, we have a growing global population. There's also this growing well, I want to really stick on this pendulum effect. So, we certainly have had a shock from the pandemic. And what I think the most common response to it has been is impatience. And people are simply no longer willing to enjoy or to wait for anything. They want to enjoy life. I had a conversation with someone recently. He was saying, we were talking about our club, and he was saying, well, he said that he went with his wife to take a tour of the club about 4 years ago, when the price of admission was a third of what it is today. And his wife didn't like it because there was a men-only bar for and that didn't gel with her sense of right. So they didn't join. And then they joined a year ago when the price of admission had gone up by three times. So his conclusion was that one really does have to just do it. There is no sense in waiting. But what that is a reflection of an inflationary mindset. Now, Japan has been trying to instill an inflationary mindset in the population for decades. So they've just changed their central banker, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of change in policy. So the yen having really strengthened up quite impressively between November and the beginning of January is now devaluing once more. So a currency devaluing is helping to support the Nikkei in nominal terms. So it was up at 349 points in here today. But if we redenominate that into US dollars, well, then you can clearly see that the market was down a few hundred points in here today, which really tells us that the performance that we had on the Japanese market today was really just about currency. And there is obviously then the clear likelihood that if they continue to avoid raising interest rates and support their quantitative easing program, that yields will exceed the 50 basis point level. But if they continue to try and target that 50 basis point level, well, inflation will start to take off. I know that Mrs. Tracy has certainly been hearing from the people that she buys Akoya pearls from in Japan, and they are certainly raising prices because they're also highlighting that their crop of pearls hasn't been quite as impressive over the last couple of years, and they're not ones to talk about climate change. But the volume of pearls that are being produced has been declining. So I do, well, I mean, I have to say that when I was in university, I learned how to dive. And I decided then that I was going to go off and dive in the best locations in the world as quickly as I could, because I wanted to see the big animals and the big pelagics before they were all gone. Because I'd been reading articles about how Taiwanese fishermen had renamed whale sharks as tofu fish because they didn't taste of anything. And then they were killing them for food. So they had basically created a market for a fish that had never been hunted before. And my conclusion at the time was that it was well worth the time and effort to go and see these incredible animals while they were still available to see. But one thing I definitely saw in diving in Sudan was coral bleaching. And this was especially interesting because where one of the locations they take you to is at where Jacques Cousteau was living underwater for several months. And in the video footage of that location, it was an incredible coral garden. But when I went to visit it in 2003, then the coral was gone. So that definitely tells us that coral bleaching is happening in the shallower depths. Now, there is lots of things we do not understand about the ocean, but we can definitely observe that calcification of the oceans and coral bleaching are certainly happening at shallow locations where the power of the sun is getting through the water faster and more aggressive than it has in the past. We also know that there are trees that are now growing within the Arctic Circle that never grew there before because it was too cold. Well, that tells us that it's getting warmer in the Arctic Circle. Now, that does not tell us how warm it's getting, how warm it's going to get, how quickly it's going to happen. I definitely saw when I was watching videos yesterday and trying to get a fuller understanding of the Gaia idea, which is very attractive, this idea that James Lovelock came up with, that the world is a self-correcting organism. And I think that does make sense. But what it also then means is we are going through different cycles. And one thing that I thought a point he made very clearly was that he was very early in predicting rapid warming, and it didn't happen. And he was asked, why didn't it happen? And he said that it was because of pollution. That in the data from millions of years ago, or no, he said within the last million years, they have data. And there were several locations when global warming had occurred, and that each of them coincided with an uptick of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So that then was translated into the volume of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere today. But the difference, of course, was that back then it was natural, and on this occasion it's artificial. So because it's being burned and because we have more smog and clouds, then more of the solar radiation is being reflected, even though the heating effect of what's going on in the world is contributing to warming. So there's a system in play, and there is equal and opposite reactions. So when one thing happens, there are unknown potential outcomes. So we know that there's warming going on. We know that there is damage being done to the oceans. We know what the potential catastrophic ramifications of that are. What we do not know is how quickly those ramifications will in fact occur. So we know, for example, that the cod fishery collapsed in the North Sea, and then it took years to repair. So it's only now, after decades, that you can buy cod in the supermarkets. So this is obviously, I think, an important consideration. One thing is the facts, but then there's also the impetus. And I think it does come back to this theme of impatience, that when we think about now the desire of investors to pioneer renewable energy, then that's a very emotional topic. But one thing also is worth considering, that politicians can't come out and say it's too late. So instead, they've decided that they're going to come out and tell us that there is the potential it can be fixed if we follow a set of new regulations. But I think that is really code for we're broke and we need more money. And the carbon credit prices went up to 100 euros this week and paused a little over the last 24 hours. But considering that these carbon credits were a lot closer to 5 euro in 2017, and considering that this is an entirely artificial construct and completely government sponsored, so governments need the money. And they are taxing polluters as a way of raising cash to pioneer this new technology. I just don't believe that it's easy to scale it. It's virtually impossible for mining companies to raise the money, sufficient quantities of money to go off and build new mines. So, when we think about, and obviously gold really has nothing to do with renewable energy, but Newcrest, for example, is starting to pull back, but it was bid for by Newmont Mining. Well, they know that they can't simply go out and buy tier one assets easily, so they have to go off and, or develop them, I should say, easily, so they have to go off and buy them. And Agnico Eagle is another company where it's got really attractive assets and they're in politically secure parts of the world. That doesn't mean that the price can't go down. And because gold prices are easing, then it's putting pressure on it. Now, the thing that I've found most interesting is commentary about copper. It was ready to pop on the upside on Wednesday, and then on Thursday and Friday it declined meaningfully, and now we're back in the region of the 200-day moving average. So this is really the do or die moment. It's either going to bounce from here or it isn't. And if interest rates continue to rise from here and inflation is stubbornly strong, well, then we're going to have to see a Another meaningful move higher in interest rates, more liquidity siphoned out of the market, and then we're likely to have a swing back in the opposite direction and get a deflationary shock. Now, that would mean that copper prices could come down really quite meaningfully. Now, copper miners are obviously impacted by that. So then the copper miner ETF is also right back in the region of that 200-day moving average. But what's most interesting is that investors have been very, or I think it's probably more accurate to say people who want to try and sell copper have been absolutely adamant that a new bull market is inevitable and that we're going to have prices that are meaningfully higher from here. Now, an electric vehicle uses about four times as much metal as an internal combustion engine. And where is that metal going to come from? The reality is that global copper demand has been falling over the last decade. It hasn't gone down a lot, but it has gone down. And all of the incremental demand growth has come from China. So we can talk until we're blue in the face about the potential for demand to grow as a result of renewable energy, not least because of new transmission cables that need to go in, the networking that's required for an array of solar panels, the volume of copper that needs to go into massive wind turbines, and then all of the effort that has to go into connecting all of that to the grid. Then creating motors, where you obviously an electric motor has lots of coil of copper inside it. You can talk about all of that demand growth, but you really can't be bullish about copper unless you're bullish about China. And what's happening in China right now is another example of impatience. So China has been, and I think it is really a hallmark of communist regimes, that they come up with these exceptionally long-term plans. The Soviet Union was talking about converting the USA into a socialist state within 100 years. Now, one might argue that they were largely successful when we look at the tenure of universities right now. But China has been playing the game of play along to get along for a long time. And that Deng's attitude was that white dog, or excuse, white cat or black cat, doesn't matter, they both catch mouse. So it was better to be wealthy. It was a glorious thing. Well, Xi Jinping is now remaking the financial system in China. So let's just simply look at the H-share index and look at it from the perspective of a long-term investor. Because from the perspective of a long-term investor, it's been super hard. And we've had a really impressive rebound off the lows at the end of last year when they exited their COVID zero policy. But what they're now doing is talking about putting one of the Politburo members as the head of the central bank, or as the vice chair of the central bank. And that would be the first time that a really senior Communist Party official was in charge of the financial system at its very core. Now, that's putting much more control in the hands of Xi Jinping, not simply in terms of the economy and the military, but then of the financial system. And when market forces are not in charge of how capital is allocated, well, then the potential for inefficiency to reign is really quite profound. So then there's obviously the potential that growth targets will not be met. And this is a really meaningful change in terms of China's governance. Since Xi Jinping took over, there has been a clear sense of impatience. Now, one thing that China has is an aging workforce. So the big threat from their perspective is that they've had these long-term plans to become the global hegemon, and that they may get old before they achieve that goal. So now we're seeing more tightening up of control in the economy, and that's not good for stock market investors. It's unlikely to be positive for the global economy and commodity demand. And there's a lot more people are worried about what's going on in China today than there were a few years ago. Now, I first went to Taiwan in 2019, and the reason I went there is because I never had the opportunity to go to Hong Kong before China took over. I wanted to go see Taipei and Taiwan before China eventually invades. And in this regard, they are biding their time. They haven't invaded for the last 40 years or before that. So they're waiting. But what exactly is it they're waiting for? There's a massive military buildup going on in China, and Japan is beginning to respond. But one thing that they're certainly waiting for is to see how does the military exchange going on in Ukraine eventually end up, because they are expending munitions in Ukraine 4 times faster than they manufacture them. Well, if that process proceeds, then it is likely that NATO will run out of munitions. So BAE Systems is popping on the upside in here and continues to march higher. And of course, one of the things that they produce, or in fact, it's not one, they produce absolutely everything that a modern military might need for a future conflict. So this continues to look like a reset in terms of global demand for defense products, because the smart thing from the perspective of China would be to wait a year and let NATO expend most of its munitions in a conventional war in Ukraine, and then simply invade Taiwan in the hope that they will not have additional munitions to supply the Taiwanese resistance. And then it would be a fait accompli. So that is obviously a potential outcome, which is, of course, why the USA is increasing its troop count in Taiwan right now. So there is certainly more impatience that plans that have been formulated for years are now being put into action. And then, of course, there is obviously, I really do, trying to figure out what exactly was going on in the Russians' minds when it comes to making the decision to invade Ukraine. And I really think that the cost associated with trying to repair all their roads and all of their infrastructure with a thawing permafrost, and that was going to be something in the order of 50 billion a year for a decade. They probably concluded that if they don't try now to secure their border. They might not be able to secure their border in future. And that, I think, was probably the certainly one of the causal factors behind the decision to invade. But what it also helps to highlight is that some countries will be in a real problem if we see a continuing trend of permafrost melting in the polar regions. And some will be greatly advantaged. So Canada is a potential area that could benefit really quite considerably. But that's nothing to do with the performance of its stock market. And the thing that I think is most particularly relevant right now is the downtrend we have in Brookfield Asset Management. This is one of the most venerated of the private equity firms. There is a clear view among investors that it will never go bust, that it has basically discovered a magic money printing machine. But how likely is that, in fact, to be true? Because interest rates have been coming down for 40 years. So anyone who borrowed money to invest in a new speculative venture could be assured of borrowing more money later at an even lower interest rate. And that really plugs a lot of holes in dodgy ventures. Well, now the trend of bonds has broken. Now, I am long of the TLT ETF, and it's currently underwater. But I'm ready to hold it because I do think that we're going to have a recession and there's going to be a deflationary shock. And then I think yields will contract. But they're not contracting right now. And when they contract, I'd be willing to sell it. And then I would also be looking at the potential here to short markets again. I was quite successful in shorting from March through to August of last year. And I think that we are being set up for another potential opportunity because if yields move north of 4% on the long end of the curve, and we are now starting to see the yield curve spread starting to turn back upwards. And that's particularly true on the 10-year minus the 3-month. We haven't quite seen it yet on the 10-year minus the 2-year. But when this spread starts to push back up through zero, that's usually when stock markets pull back most sharply. I really think that the pullback that we saw last year was about valuation contraction. So that's why we had the most overvalued portions of the market pull back the most. We have not yet seen a big hit to earnings. We haven't seen consumers having to pull back. Now, we know that the number of defaults in Europe is rising, and we know that the number of people that are defaulting on their auto loans is rising. But credit card delinquencies haven't really moved, and we still have most people employed. And what's interesting about this particular environment is that it is white-collar workers are being let go. So, McKinsey, for example, let 2,000 people go this week. So that means that there's less demand from companies for advice on how to better manage their businesses. And you don't pay for consultants when you're firing workers. You might pay for them when you're thinking about who to fire. But when you're firing the consultants, it's generally an indication that things are looking pretty hairy. And of course, we've also had the major tech companies, which have been firing people quite aggressively. But it's the smaller companies have not been firing people, and it's usually the other way around. What is interesting right now is that the performance of those eight companies is rolling over relative to the wider market. So this is looking increasingly like a complete top. And therefore, the easy answer for how to outperform the market is don't own those eight companies. As we think about the pendulum, then swinging back into a deflationary environment, that will favor growthy kinds of stocks, but perhaps not immediately, because what I find especially interesting is that the subscription business model is really under pressure. So Adobe basically invented it, and their share peaked in 2021, and now it's coming back down. And the reason it's coming back down is because the product that they had was the only product that could do photo editing for years. And now there's lots of products that do photo editing, and you don't have to pay a fortune every month to buy them. Now, Autodesk has computer-aided design software. It also peaked in 2021. They adopted the subscription business model, and now video editing software is a lot easier to come by. So they have more competition, and that's going to create pricing pressure. Well, Amazon has a subscription business model, and it's also trending downwards. So we've definitely seen that a market that really was prizing the reliability of subscriptions, and it contributed to this incredible performance by Microsoft. But Microsoft is has been coming down for a year, that it bounced impressively, but it's back below the 200-day moving average this week. And it's another example of a subscription business model company that has rolled over. Now, but of course, what this also helps to highlight is that when everybody runs a subscription business, well, then eventually consumers can't have all of them, and they need to make tough decisions about which ones they hold on to. So Netflix had the big was fell most first among the large cap companies, then rebounded most impressively, and now this is the biggest downward dynamic we've seen in quite a while. If it doesn't bounce next week, having encountered resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, I think that there is clear potential that it's going to come straight back down and test the lows, and that we could easily see a type 3 bottom forming that could last years. And the higher interest rates go, the more pressure that comes to bear on consumers, the more decisions that are made about the kinds of services they're willing to pay for on an ongoing basis indefinitely, then the more competition there will be among these subscription-oriented businesses. And I think this is going to be a significant factor in the upcoming recession, because the valuation that's been attached to the reliability of cash flows within these businesses has been very high. And when that reliability factor deteriorates, then it turns into a self-feeding negative trend. And that's an additional factor, because the subscription business model was the innovation in business practices that drove the last bull market, and now it's not as valuable as it was in the past. So I think these are important characteristics to pay attention to. We are now coming towards the end of this inflationary spike, and if we're not there yet, we'll be there soon, because monetary tightening is catching up. We had a lot of tightening in a very short period of time, and it acts with a lagged effect. So that lag is catching up. we will have a deflationary shock that will drive prices down and create a very attractive buying opportunity. That we're going to see a lot of valuations at very attractive prices. The stocks that bottom first will be the candidates for the next big move in markets. There will certainly be more money flowing into infrastructure. There will likely be a lot more government-focused attention to where money flows. And that's going to be equally true in the West as it is in China. There is inevitably going to be more money spent on arms and armament, because we are moving into a progressively more geopolitically tense environment. Not only do we have a conflict between Russia and China and the rest of the world, or at least Russia and China and NATO, but that in the event that climate becomes much more volatile, then there will be a significant threat of migration. And if populations are prevented from migrating, well, then that will enhance the potential for wars. So defense is likely to be a significant trend over the next decade. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.